VOA1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Dan Friedel, Anna Mateo, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
As leaders meet in Scotland for the United Nations Conference on Climate Change, a real-time battle to defend Mexican forest land continues. There, on the Yucatan Peninsula, people are working to protect and expand mangrove forests. The low trees grow in watery areas near ocean coasts. They provide a defensive shelter from dangers like big storms. They also capture carbon dioxide, the main waste gas that drives Earth's rising temperature. Years ago, mangroves were all along the Yucatan shores. Today, there are few. A team of villagers from the area is trying to renew the forests. Scientists and donations support the effort. The Mexican government helps pay training costs of the team. The villagers joined the renewal effort more than 10 years ago with scientist Jorge Alfredo Herrera of the Center for Research and Advanced Studies of the Mexican Polytechnic Institute in Yucatan. He told them the mangroves needed a network of connected canals where fresh and salt water could mix. The dig was going to be hard work, and the pay was only $4 a day. A group of women from Chelem, a fishing village, took the jobs, believing they could make substantial gains with little money. Recently, after a heavy rainy season, the workers finished the second part of the process, planting young mangroves near the city. They placed 20-inch mangrove seeds into small hills of mud, creating islands about a meter square in size. "The happiest day is when our plants take," said 41-year-old Kayla Vasquez. "They are like our children."
This mangrove renewal effort is similar to others around the world. Scientists and community groups are increasingly recognizing the need to protect and bring back the forests. "Mangroves represent a very important ecosystem to fight climate change," said Octavio Aburto. He is a marine biologist at Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego, California. "While the tropical trees only grow on less than 1% of the Earth's land," he said, "they can bury around 5 times more carbon in the sediment than a tropical rainforest." Yet around the world, mangroves are being destroyed. From 1980 to 2005, as much as 35% of the world's mangroves disappeared, says the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. In Mexico, as in much of the world, development is the main threat to mangrove existence. The area of Cancun lost most of its mangroves to roads and hotels starting in the 1980s. Mangroves on the country's southern Pacific Ocean coast also have been cleared to make room for fish farms. Oil industry operations in waters off the Gulf of Mexico threaten mangroves there too, said Aburto. Mexico started to protect its mangroves in the 1980s. Mexico took steps to create a climate action plan in 1998 and was one of the first developing countries to sign on to the Paris Climate Accord. But Julia Carabias of the National Autonomous University of Mexico says the country's government has been reducing its support recently. Carabias says resources for environmental protection were cut by 60% in the past 6 years.
There have been some restoration efforts around the world to protect mangroves. In 2020, the Indonesian government set a target of planting mangroves on more than 600 hectares of coastline by 2024. Government agencies are involved in renewal efforts that include community outreach and education. I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
The blue whale is the largest animal to ever live on our planet. You might wonder how much such a large creature eats. Well, you are not alone. Scientists recently carried out a study to find out how much blue whales and some of their closest relatives eat in a day. Their findings were not surprising. They found the whales eat a lot. In just one day, blue whales living in the North Pacific Ocean can eat about 14.5 metric tons of krill. Krill are crustaceans and look like very small shrimp. That means blue whales eat around 1,450 metric tons of food every year. Matthew Savoca of Stanford University was the lead writer of the study, which appeared recently in the publication Nature. When speaking of the findings, Savoca said, "It's an unimaginable amount of food." Nick Pyonson was the co-writer of the study. He said the amount of food blue whales eat in a day is about the weight of one fully loaded school bus. Pyonson works at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. He is an expert in the study of extinct marine mammals. Savoca also described the blue whale's size as unimaginable. Blue whales are larger than even the biggest dinosaurs. They can grow to 33 meters long and weigh about 181 metric tons. The animal can grow to about the size of a Boeing 737 airplane. For the study, the researchers followed 321 whales living in the Atlantic, Pacific, and Southern Oceans. Some were blue whales. The rest were six other baleen whale species: humpback, fin, bowhead, right, Antarctic minke, and Bruda's whales. These huge ocean mammals were found to eat up to three times more food than scientists had earlier thought. To measure the amount of food the whales ate and to study eating behaviors, the researchers used many devices. Electronic tag devices were attached to the animal's back. They also used cameras, microphones, a GPS locator device, and an instrument that follows movement. They used drones to estimate the size of a whale's mouth area
and how much food it could eat at one time. And they used instruments that recorded sound waves to estimate the amount of food in the waters near the whales. I'm Ana Mateo.
The American Space Agency, NASA, is seeking help from the public to identify important images captured by Mars explorers. The project is designed to help teach an artificial intelligence, AI, system to recognize different scientific elements seen in the pictures. Some of the images were captured by Perseverance, NASA's latest Mars rover, or explorer. Others came from the agency's Spirit and Opportunity rovers. AI plays an important part in NASA's efforts to process data collected by its spacecraft and exploring vehicles. The space agency develops AI algorithms to identify and group elements of scientific interest. But the algorithms must be trained by humans in order for them to work. That is where private citizens can help. NASA says Perseverance can send hundreds of images to Earth on any given day. Scientists and engineers examine the images as they search for different geological qualities of the surface of Mars. These images can also help guide Perseverance and other rovers operating on Mars. But the team on Earth faces a very short timeline. NASA said in a recent statement, after those images travel millions of miles from Mars to Earth, the team members have a matter of hours to develop the next set of instructions. Those instructions, based on what the NASA team sees in the images, must then be sent back to Perseverance. Vivian Sun is a scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. She helps oversee the daily operations of Perseverance. She also advises those who run the public project called AI for Mars. It's not possible for any one scientist to look at all the downlinked images with scrutiny in such a short amount of time every single day, Sun said in an online statement. It would save us time if there was an algorithm that could say, "I think I saw rock veins or nodules over here," and then the science team can look at those areas with more detail. The AI for Mars project aims to build a large, solid set of data created from thousands of images. Researchers can use these images to quickly discover interesting geological features. It is much easier for other AI researchers to train their algorithms on available pictures of many earthly things. But NASA did not have such a massive collection of Mars images to work with. Citizen scientists who wish to take part in the AI for Mars project can visit a special website to start. There, users will find an online tool that can be used to make lines around features in the images, such as sand and different kinds of rock. Once these features are marked, a user can choose from descriptions that fit what is in the images. NASA says the latest version of the AI for Mars system lets people choose more detailed descriptions. Annie Didier is a JPL scientist who works on the Perseverance version of AI for Mars. She said creating a strong data set can serve several important purposes. With this algorithm, the rover could automatically select science targets to drive to, she said. It could also permit rovers on Mars to store numerous images and then send back only the ones that scientists are interested in, she added. NASA says AI for Mars is the continuation of another project launched last year that used images collected by the Curiosity rover. In that project, people were able to outline and mark features like sand and rock from nearly 500,000 images. The result of that effort was an algorithm called Soil Property and Object Classification. NASA says that system can correctly identify the features it was trained on about 98% of the time. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the early weeks of 1863, the American Civil War took a new political direction. President Abraham Lincoln had announced the Emancipation Proclamation. That measure freed the slaves in the rebel states of the South, though Lincoln's words fell on deaf ears. Yet no longer was the Civil War a struggle just to save the Union. It had become a struggle for human freedom. There was a change on the military side of the war, too. President Lincoln named a new commander for the Union's Army of the Potomac. This was the force that would try again to capture the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant describe events during the spring of 1863.
General Joe Hooker was the new commander of the Army of the Potomac. He replaced General Ambrose Burnside when Burnside suffered a terrible defeat at Fredericksburg, Virginia, at the end of 1862. Burnside had replaced General George McClellan when McClellan kept refusing to obey President Lincoln's orders. Hooker had 130,000 men. They were well trained and well supplied. The Confederate force opposing Hooker's was under the command of General Robert E. Lee. Lee had only about 60,000 men. They did not have good equipment, and their supplies were low. But their fighting spirit was high. They had defeated the Union Army before. They were sure they could do it again.
Lee's army still held strong defensive positions along high ground south of Fredericksburg. This was almost halfway between the capitals of the opposing sides, Washington and Richmond. General Hooker did not plan to make the same mistake which General Burnside made at Fredericksburg. Burnside had thrown his army against Lee's defensive positions 6 times. Each time, the Confederates pushed them back easily. In one day of fighting, more than 12,000 Union soldiers were killed or wounded. General Hooker had rebuilt the Army of the Potomac. Now he was ready to carry out his plan against General Lee. Hooker left half his men at Fredericksburg in front of Lee's army. He would move the other half into position behind Lee's army. If Lee turned to meet him, the troops at Fredericksburg would attack. The Confederate army would be caught between two powerful forces. Lee would have to withdraw or lose his army.
Hooker moved around past the end of Lee's line. Then he turned and started marching back behind it. It was a hard march through thick woods and across rough hills and valleys. The country was so wild that it was called the Wilderness. On the last day of April 1863, the Union force reached Chancellorsville. Chancellorsville was a crossroads near the edge of the Wilderness. The next day, the soldiers would be in open country. There, General Hooker could make the best use of his men. Hooker was extremely pleased. Everything was going as he had planned. He told his officers, "I have Lee in one hand and Richmond in the other." The next day, Union soldiers began moving out of Chancellorsville and the Wilderness. They did not get far. They ran into several thousand Confederate soldiers. Lee had sent them to slow the Union force.
The Confederate force was weak. General Hooker's officers believed they could smash through it without difficulty. They did not get a chance to try. Hooker sent new orders. Break off the fight. Return to Chancellorsville. Put up defensive positions. Hooker's officers were shocked. They protested. Hooker stood firm. He said, "Lee must fight me on my own ground." Robert E. Lee could not understand why the Union force had returned to Chancellorsville. But he was happy it did. Now he had time to prepare his men for battle.
Lee met that night with his top general, Stonewall Jackson. They discussed the best way to attack the Union force. The center of the Union line was strong. The right side was not. Jackson was sure he could get around behind it. Lee asked Jackson how many men he would take. "All of them," Jackson answered, 28,000. This meant Lee would have only 14,000 men to face General Hooker. If the Union force attacked before Stonewall Jackson got into position, Lee could not possibly hold it back. Lee was taking a huge chance. He thought about it for a moment. Then he told Jackson to get started.
Jackson's men began to leave the next morning. Union soldiers watched as they marched away. General Hooker thought Lee was withdrawing. It took Jackson only half a day to get behind the Union force. He spent a few more hours putting his troops into position. Then he attacked. It was 6 o'clock in the evening. The right end of the Union force was not prepared for an attack. The soldiers could not believe their eyes when they saw Confederate troops running out of the woods behind them. Many Union soldiers were killed or wounded. Thousands fled. The sun went down. The fighting continued under a bright moon. The Confederate troops kept moving forward. The Union troops kept falling back. One Northern soldier wrote later, "Darkness was upon us. Jackson was upon us. And fear was upon us."
Jackson seemed to be everywhere. He rode his horse among his men, urging them forward. He would not let the Union force escape. As Jackson and some of his officers rode into a cleared area of the woods, shots rang out. The bullets came from Confederate guns. The Confederate soldiers thought they were firing on Union officers. Jackson fell from his horse. Two bullets had smashed his left arm. Another bullet had hit his right hand. He was hurried to the back of the line. A doctor quickly cut off his left arm and stopped the heavy bleeding. Jackson seemed to get better. Then he developed pneumonia. He was unconscious most of the time. He seemed to dream of battle and shouted commands to his officers. Then he grew quiet. He opened his eyes and said, "Let us pass over the river and rest in the shade of the trees." The great Confederate general Stonewall Jackson was dead.
While Jackson lay dying, the Battle of Chancellorsville continued. Robert E. Lee's Confederate army was much smaller than Joe Hooker's Union army. But for 5 days, Lee kept part of his army moving between Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg. Wherever the Union army attacked, Lee quickly added more men to his lines. The Union army could not break through. The fighting was taking place on the south side of the Rappahannock River. The Union Army's supply lines were on the north side. Spring rains were beginning to make the Rappahannock rise. General Hooker did not want to get trapped without food and ammunition, so he ordered his men back across the river.
The South had won the Battle of Chancellorsville. Robert E. Lee was sure of that. Once again, he had forced back the Army of the Potomac. But the Union Army was not hurt seriously. New soldiers would soon take the place of those lost in battle. Lee, however, would find it more difficult to replace his soldiers. The South was running out of manpower. Every Confederate army needed men. More and more men. Yet fewer and fewer Southern boys were willing to become soldiers. Anti-war movements were, in fact, active in both the North and South. There were a number of protests against the military draft. Some turned violent. In the North, a political party was created to oppose the Civil War. Leaders of this peace party were called Copperheads. They got the name because they wore a copper penny showing the head of an Indian. That will be our story in our next program on the Civil War.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.